Translation by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. A person influenced by the external energy is called Bahirmukha Jana, a mundane person, because despite his perception, he cannot understand the real substance. Hearing Gopinath Acharya say this, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya smiled and began to speak as follows. Purport: when one's heart is not cleansed, one cannot awaken the transcendental nature of devotional service. As Lord Krishna confirms in the Bhagavad Gita 7:28, Yesham Tvantagatam Papam Jananam Punya Karmanam Tidvandva Moha Nirmukta Bhajante Mam Dridavrataha. Persons who have acted piously in previous lives and in this life, and whose sinful actions are completely eradicated, are freed from the dualities of delusion, and they engage themselves in my service with determination. When one is actually engaged in pure devotional service, it is understood that he has already attained freedom from all reactions to sinful activities. In other words, it is to be understood that the devotees are already freed from sin. A sinful person, a miscreant, duṣkṛti, cannot engage in devotional service, nor can one engage in devotional service simply on the basis of scholarly speculation. One has to wait for the mercy of the Lord in order to render pure devotional service. Srila Prabhupada ki. Om Jnanati Mirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Nama Nama Om Vishnu Vinaya Krishna Krishna Mutlesh. So an interesting chastisement from Gopinath Acharya to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. And they're of course engaged in a conversation where Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya has sometime earlier seen the ecstatic symptoms of Mahaprabhu in the Puri temple. And after the Lord fainted, he then brought him to his home and looked after him and made him comfortable. But Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya is not conversant with the status of the Lord. He sees him as some exceptional person who has clearly done something amazing, because he was sufficiently elevated that he could see uncommon symptoms manifested in the Lord's body when he fell down and was unconscious and expressing many factors in that whole pastime, a mixture of consciousness and unconsciousness. So he could see that there's something very special with this person, but he didn't know that he was the Supreme Lord. And being of the Mayavad persuasion, it wasn't going to come to him easily either. So therefore, this is Gopinath Acharya's preaching to him to try to encourage him to see the truth about Mahaprabhu. And so they're having a discussion where in the previous verses, he's mentioned that Gopinath Acharya is making the case for Lord Chaitanya's supremacy. And he's saying, okay, you've seen the uncommon symptoms in the body of Mahaprabhu. You know that no one else can do this. There's clearly something special here. And your unfortunate condition is that despite the fact that you've seen all these wonderful features, you still cannot come to the conclusion that this is the Supreme Lord. So he's chastising him and criticizing him in one sense. So at this point, Gopinath Acharya is, you can say, is quite forcefully stating the facts. Now, there is a relationship between Gopinath Acharya and Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, so therefore there is a certain license to be rather strong in the arguments. So we just have to be careful if we try and do that with everyone who doesn't understand that the Supreme Lord is the Supreme Lord. There's a relationship here as well that has to be understood. So he's very forcefully and very precisely giving evidence for why Lord Chaitanya is the Supreme Lord. And he is now also pointing out the flaw in Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya's character. And this flaw is not that he has a lack of knowledge, but that he is unfortunate. Because to actually see the Supreme Lord and understand the Supreme Lord's mercy, His power, His existence even as the Supreme Lord requires the mercy of the Supreme Lord. It's impossible to even perceive the Lord while you're standing right next to Him if you do not have the mercy of the Lord. Just imagine we have been, I say, carrying the Lord around, but really He moves according to His own free will as the super soul in our body for our entire life, and not just this life, multiple lifetimes before, probably many to come if we don't exit this situation. He's there right next to us, Surit, right in the heart, right next to us, the best friend, the well-wisher of all living entities, but He remains completely undetectable to most people. So that is something incredible. We have so many mystical statements in the Gita. He's within, He's without. You know, sometimes people, they hear all these amazing statements and they are confused. They do not know what is what. Ascharya, they are amazed. They hear this truth about the Lord. They hear His difference from the difference between Him and matter. And they're simply amazed. Some hear of the soul is amazing, right? Verse in the Gita. Others cannot describe Him at all. So it remains a mystery. So having proximity to something does not necessarily guarantee an understanding of it. And this point has been demonstrated multiple times in the Gita and in the Bhagavatam. In the Gita, you have a mention of, and in the Mahabharata in general, you have the Kauravas, Duryodhan, Dhritarashtra, who didn't really explicitly or directly accept Krishna as the Supreme Lord, even though He was in their midst so frequently, and they interacted with Him, but they couldn't detect Him. They saw Him as some ordinary person, some mystic, someone who does mischief, who does mischievous things for His devotees. And this is actually a mood adopted by demons in general. They consider that Lord Vishnu is a troublesome character who is very, very powerful. Only a fool denies the power of the Lord. I mean, definitely there are in the scriptures many examples of persons who denied the authority of the Lord, who thought He was a mundane person. And Krishna corrected that misunderstanding quite quickly. A little Sudarshan Chakra operation or a little display of some mystic siddhi or something like that very quickly corrected their understanding that at least here is someone who is very, very powerful. At least you have to understand that. This person is powerful. So the demons accept the power of the Lord. And certainly the incarnations of Jay and Vijay, when they come as Hiranyaksha, Hiranyakashipu, they accept the power of the Lord. They know Lord Vishnu is very powerful. And they also think that Lord Vishnu acts to protect His devotees, who are the demigods. And because those demoniac persons are not favorable to the Lord, they always end up in trouble. So they always have this idea that Lord Vishnu is there and He always does mischievous things to protect His devotees because He's favorable to them. But they accept that He's powerful. So that is how Lord Vishnu is perceived, as a powerful person who sides with certain groups of people. Now, of course, that is due to a misunderstanding. That is due to the demoniac persons being fixed in a mental situation which is described here in today's verses, bahirmukha, external. So the demons cannot understand the mystery of the Lord's actions. We know that janma karma chame divyam evam yoveti tatvata tyaktva deham punarjanma naiti mameti sorjana. That one has to understand the transcendental nature of the Lord's appearance and His activities. His janma and karma have to be understood. So those with a demoniac mentality do not accept that the Lord's birth is anything transcendental. And they also do not appreciate or understand that His activities are also transcendental. So they view the Lord and everything He does with a mundane material viewpoint. And that is exactly what is described here with these terms, bahir mukha jana. A person influenced by the external energy. If you don't know the correct method or the correct mood or the correct metrics by which to assess the Lord, the conclusion you will come to, the conclusions that you will come to will be wrong. And with that, at best, you may have an understanding of the Lord's power or his punishment capability, but you will completely miss the actual identity of the Lord and his qualities and his real character. And so, if Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya stands any chance of understanding the Supreme Lord in truth, he has to overcome this mentality of his, that he's viewing from externals. He has seen something extraordinary in the person of Lord Chaitanya, but he is trying to process it with mundane logic, with mundane calculations and a mundane, a method of working of the mind. To perceive something spiritual and appreciate it requires something a little more than a typical mundane mind. Now, we know in this world that different people have different levels of mind and intelligence. Some people's mental capabilities are exceptionally low. Some people's mental capabilities are exceptionally high. Some are highly intelligent, others are highly unintelligent. It's a fact, isn't it? Can anyone deny that? You look around the world, you will see a spectrum of capability ranging from the lowest to the highest. And depending on how capable one is, one can be more or less successful in this world. A person who is highly intelligent, has a good mind, which works very robustly, and then works under discipline, can actually achieve many successful things in this world. But a person who is lazy, who cannot control their mind for more than 2 minutes, who has a thought in their mind one moment, and a couple of moments later they're thinking something completely the opposite, it's not really going to be really successful in terms of their endeavor in this world. Or a person who cannot process and analyze the world might not have much success. Of course, this is all the mundane mechanical calculation that I'm giving you. It is still possible that a person who is completely incompetent can actually be quite successful in the world due to karma. A person can be totally unintelligent, totally undisciplined, but they might be phenomenally wealthy, for example, due to their karma. So these are the interplays that are possible in this world. It's not the external possession or display or status that necessarily demonstrates one's actual acumen at this point in time. But it is a fact, in general, that those who have a higher level of acumen will generally do better in the world. We can see that. Putting the exceptions aside, we can generally see that a person who is competent, who learns his profession well, who practices, who re-practices until they're excellent, can actually do a good job. That's available to most people. So in the mundane world, one's faculties will help one succeed. So in the spiritual world, or if we're trying to understand spiritual subject matter, we need to now be retrained to understand what are the parameters by which spiritual subjects can be understood. We cannot apply our mundane calculations anymore. Here is the Supreme Lord, and he is capable of disguising himself so perfectly that he can be right next to you, right inside you, and you will never detect him. Or he can manifest before you in a form which leaves you in no doubt that he's the Supreme Lord. But he remains the Supreme Lord in both of those cases. And so, if we just analyze that point, we can see that a different type of calculation or perception is needed to detect the Lord. That perception or calculation cannot be learned through any material techniques. It cannot be learned through a process of meditation, for example. It's very popular to promote meditation, closing your eyes, chanting Om, perhaps even, as a means of spiritual advancement. Now, Om certainly is pranava, Pranava Sarva Vedeshu Shabdake Paurusham Rishu. As it says in the Gita, I am the primeval, transcendental sound vibration Om. Definitely. Very, very powerful. Very special. But Om, chanted by a person who has material motivations, who has adopted a process from an unqualified person, does not yield the results that Om can yield. Om is a powerful, ancient, Vedic mantra, preposition. It is a very, very powerful thing. But when utilized, as is the case today, by the business yogis, if you like, I call them business yogis, because their purpose in yoga is to simply create a business by which they make money. So Prabhupada was strongly critical of this. This is a highly undesirable development. Yoga is the ancient science of linking oneself to God. And definitely there are various branches which deal with different aspects. Physical training, physical strength is a part of it, but it is not the goal. So when yoga is misrepresented to mean one thing or another thing, you actually diminish the real value that lies within yoga. Imagine if someone's given you a diamond and you don't know anything better, you like the look of it, maybe it's a rough, uncut diamond. If you come across an uncut diamond, it's not particularly impressive. You know, it looks rather rough. It doesn't have the finesse of a diamond beautifully cut and polished and set in a headpiece or anything like that. It looks like something amazing, maybe something heavy, like a piece of quartz maybe or something. And if someone gives you that and they tell you this is a paperweight, you can use it as a paperweight. It makes a very good paperweight. Stops your papers moving around. Okay, fine. You can use it as a paperweight. But they didn't tell you something else, that diamond actually has immense value. And if you were to have it professionally cut and polished and prepared nicely, you could buy millions of paperweights, assuming you needed a paperweight. You could buy millions of practically anything if you had such a large, beautiful diamond. So actually, when someone gives you something, takes an original, highly potent item, like yoga, and gives you an explanation which is highly mundane and is such a minor subset of what is possible, what it actually does is it dulls your consciousness into understanding its full glories. You never explore beyond that point. Unless, of course, you practice whatever's being recommended and you realize it doesn't work. But for some period of time, you could be wasting a lot of time trying to do something with the aim of becoming physically fit, perhaps, with the aim of becoming steady in mind. And these are all good things, but they're not the goal. They're not the goal for practitioners of genuine yoga. So with these examples, we can understand that when we take something that is highly potent, highly spiritual, and we receive an explanation which is substandard, it actually prevents us moving forward and uncovering the real glories. So Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, being of the Mayavad conception, is not interested in a form of the Lord beyond the impersonal Brahman. In fact, from the Mayavad conception, the impersonal is considered to sometimes manifest personal, but that is a subservient feature. It doesn't make much sense to devotees how something impersonal can manifest something personal. But to them it makes sense. So we'll just go with it for the time being. That okay, something impersonal manifests something personal, and because it's subservient, they always see it as actually it's just a small feature of the impersonal. But if the impersonal has no features, how can you have an aspect coming from the impersonal? So you see what happens is with this type of philosophy, it prevents you moving forward. when you've actually negated the possibility that the Supreme Lord has a personality, a form, name, fame, qualities, character, pastimes, and you are simply focused on one aspect of His, Brahmano hi pratishtaham, He's the basis of the impersonal Brahman, when you're only focused on that aspect of His and you think that's the goal, you're in trouble. At least you're in trouble as far as understanding the ultimate truth is concerned. Or if, as the Gita says, bhoga ishvariya prasaktanam tahyaparati chetasam vyavasayatmika buddhi samado na vidiyate, that persons who are overly engrossed or overly attached to bhoga and aishvariya, material opulence, and raising oneself to the heavenly planets, for them, their whole plans, their whole mind is occupied with programs for material prosperity. Therefore, there is no capacity left in the mind to go any higher. They think there is nothing higher than this, because their entire conception of something very high is filled with a very mundane level of understanding. So to move from these levels of small amounts of revelation, you know, partial revelation, we can say, partial education, to move from these levels to a higher understanding of the Lord's personality, His glories, His capabilities, and our relationship with Him requires different techniques, and it requires different teachers. The mundane teachers cannot help at all in this regard. Only devotees can help. Devotees who are in contact with the Supreme Lord, or who are in the process of becoming in intimate contact with the Supreme Lord, having heard from others who are in contact with the Supreme Lord. That is the secret. And so persons who are averse to the association of devotees will never understand the Supreme Lord. They may understand many aspects of the Supreme Lord, and the entire material world, in one sense, is aspects of the Supreme Lord, His external energy. Bahir, His external energy. It's not the real goal. But there's enough variety, there's enough material there to keep us occupied, entertained, and completely distracted for lifetimes. You can uncover, explore, research the material world so much, and there'll never be any end to it, because it is far more elaborate than our mind can conceive. And that will keep you occupied. So where is the question then that we will spontaneously think of looking for the transcendental world, which is so much larger, so much bigger, so much better, it's full of so many dealings which are impossible here in this material world? It is only possible by the mercy of a devotee. And it is only by Gopinath Acharya's potency here and his mercy that he's shown to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, that Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya has a chance to hear about the Lord's pastimes. What we're hearing and what we're reading in this section is the process by which Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya is going from the stage of being a non-believer in the personality of the Lord to being a great devotee. So it's very instructive. This whole discourse has been conducted on the basis of proper evidence and solid shastric backup. That's actually what Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya and his disciples demanded. When Gopinath Acharya declared to them that here is the Supreme Lord, they said, well, you have to explain it. How is he the Supreme Lord? Where does it say in the scripture that he is the Supreme Lord? What is your source of authority? What is your evidence? What is your pramanam? We spoke about pramanams last time, previous times, and we spoke last time, I think it was New Year's Day, on the importance of substance. So the substance of understanding the existence of the Lord is a mystery to everyone except devotees. And devotees are not whimsical. They are not creating their explanations out of thin air, whatever suits the agenda. I have an agenda, therefore I will say whatever it takes to this person in order to have my agenda fulfilled. No. Devotees do not say a word unless it is backed up, authorized, and explained by Shastra and the Acharyas. Anything that a devotee speaks comes from Shastra. So we can see that being a devotee is uncommon and it requires different capabilities. Now in this verse, one of the typical disqualifications for someone in becoming a devotee is described, the disqualification. It says, Yesham Tvantagatam Papam. So those who have acted sinfully in past lives and perhaps in this life, and whose actions are not completely eradicated, they cannot understand the Supreme Lord. So we have to actually develop some purity. So this is why, alongside a process of study, spiritual practice, chanting the holy name, Prabhupada also put in place measures to prevent us increasing our stock of papam. Yesham tvantagatam papam. We've been increasing it life after life. Therefore, at least we now need to stop that process. Four regulative principles. These are the stoppers. Sri Sri Radha Gokulananda Ki. These regulative principles, which some people call restraints, they restrict us doing things we like to do. Actually, if you think about it, all of these things that the regulative principles keep us away from, they're not actually that nice anyway. Just materially, they're horrible things. Meat eating is horrible. Who likes to slaughter? Only very sick people like to slaughter. Only people who are very cruel. But you may do it because you don't know. Most people, you know, when they eat some meat product, they're not thinking. They're not imagining all the slaughter, the pain that's gone on. Or they've justified it somehow by saying, this is nature. This is how it works in the wild. You know, we're just the higher living entity deals with the lower. It's just the way it goes. But most sane people are averse to the idea when it is first presented to them that this has come at the cost of great bloodshed. Most sane people are averse to it because they know, simple. When you cut yourself, when you hurt yourself, someone attacks you, it's painful. It doesn't require a great deal of learning or study to know that it's not nice. So it's very simple to simply extend it to another animal. Do you think really this animal likes to have its throat slit? Do you think so? You have a little cut on your hand, it's so painful. Do you think this animal is happy at what you're doing to it? So they're not nice things anyway. Meat eating, intoxication, illicit sex, gambling. We don't need to go through each one of them, but if you think about it, you realize they're not even nice things. So the regulative principles protect you from them, first of all. And actually we call them the regulative principles of freedom. They're not traps, they're not restraints. I mean, in one sense they're a restraint, in the same way that a seatbelt is a restraint. If you have a little bit of intelligence, you will put on your seatbelt if you're driving. If you don't, you can be irresponsible and say, it doesn't matter. After all, seatbelts were only mandatory 20 years ago. Before that, it was fine. No one wore them. Therefore, it's okay. Well, you'd be a fool if you did that. Just because there's a history of foolishness does not mean that the foolishness should continue now. That's a general principle in life. Just because people have done foolish things for lifetime, for years and years and decades, does not mean that we continue that foolishness. It's time to stop it at some point. So seatbelt, you wear a seatbelt, yes, it's uncomfortable, it's annoying, you might have to keep adjusting it, pulls against you, but hey, it might save your life. Is that important? Hopefully, most people would say it is important. So we do things sometimes that are temporarily inconvenient, but have a much bigger benefit. So for some, the regulative principles can be like that. If you happen to be addicted to any of these items, then yes, maybe the regulative principle is best seen as a little seatbelt, a little restraint for a period of time. So these regulative principles help us and they stop us increasing our stock of pap, our stock of bad karma. And what is the problem with this bad karma? We know spiritual life is transcendental. So what is the problem with continuously increasing our stock of sinful activities? Well, the problem is it doesn't allow us to detach from our view of the world based upon duality, hankering, dislike, hatred, liking. These are the tools by which the material world works and by which people assess things in the material world. That is our theme, if you remember. We're trying to figure out how to assess something that is spiritual or how to consider something that is spiritual. And it is not done through likes and dislikes, hankering, illusion, hatred, raga, dvesha. Ragadvesha vimuktaistu indriyash charan. The senses, the mind, I like this, I don't like this. These are not the symptoms by which you can come into contact and understand spiritual subject matters. So we have to do things to stop that process. So the regulative principles help, and then the philosophy helps, and then the association of devotees helps. And what we do is we actually hear about the real qualities that allow us to perceive the existence of the Lord. And those real qualities are revealed by the Lord when he sees that we are sincere about progressing in spiritual life. Initially, he will send us some devotees. We will receive a book from a devotee. We will receive some uplifting words from a devotee. Initially, we may even hear something from a devotee and not be particularly impressed. But we might remember it. On the street, someone said this to me, and I thought, what a fool. But then a few years later, you're still thinking what they said. And at some point, when your receptivity has increased, that profound statement might actually start to spark, might actually start to flourish. So you don't know. Krishna, through his various means and techniques and elaborate plans, brings a person into the association of devotees and gives them a chance to hear about him. Then when the devotee hears about him, so many things happen. Inauspicious things in the heart are destroyed. One becomes situated, the effects of the modes decreases. The knot in the heart is slackened, knot of material attachment. One becomes perceptive to the existence of the Supreme Lord. Jnana Deepena Bhashvata. Krishna says that to those who worship me, who are dedicated to me, who offer their obeisances to me, who are fully devoted to me, I destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. That is the only way. It is not through any other study or anything like that. We hear about the glories of the devotees. We study the glories, the glorious pastimes of the Lord, only to come to the conclusion that it is the Lord's mercy that will save us. So therefore we chant his holy names, we serve the devotees. And here Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya really is getting an unprecedented chance. He normally has no chance to understand the glories of the Lord because he has put them aside, he has dismissed them. So here by the persistence, the persuasion, and the real competence of Gopinath Acharya and the devotees, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya has the chance actually to transform himself from a quite advanced Mayavadi to now becoming an extremely exalted devotee. So that is possible. You can see the miraculous possibility of that only by the mercy of the Lord. So I'll stop there and see if there are any questions, comments. Yes? You can give her the mic. Yeah.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji, thank you. It was an extremely wonderful class. So I just have a question about how do you unlearn everything you've learned? It's extremely difficult. And the other question is, what if you are in the association of devotees, but can it get confusing sometimes? Because sometimes you have like, you know, the school of your grandmother, the school of your father, school of your mother. And if everyone is devotees, then they're always giving you so much constructive feedback that it's overwhelming. So how do you use that mercy? How do you navigate through it?
The first one was how to undo some of the...
How do you unlearn?
Unlearn. Unlearn the misconceptions.
How do you unlearn everything you've learned? You know, we go through this really thorough, educative process in our life.
So we can... we don't have to... we don't have to be so hard on ourselves that we think that everything I have done so far is completely useless. Sometimes we do that, and it might be a tool that we use sometimes also. But it's not necessarily a comprehensive way to look at the world, look at things. We can be like hunters of gold. You know, gold can be found in all sorts of places. Gold is transacted by rogues for nefarious purposes on a daily basis. It's also transacted by saintly persons. It remains pure in itself as a means of currency. So it is not the case necessarily that everything we have learned, everything we have heard, every interaction we've had is completely useless and completely problematic. Actually, if we look back through our lives, Krishna, because he's Surit and he's with us and he's our well-wisher, he has been actually helping us in our lives in so many ways, but we have not perceived it necessarily, or we have not acknowledged it, that that was the help of the Lord. So actually a more progressive thing to do is to try to look back in our life and think of the various incidents, steps, occurrences that took place, maybe even decisions we made that have now actually helped us come to a point of wanting to take our devotion further. That way we're not in an artificial program of rejecting anything. Because we also, as devotees, don't have a policy of rejecting. Jnana Vairagya. Vairagya is not a policy of ours. It is something that is a side effect of a desire to advance in devotion. When you want devotional service, when you want the Supreme Lord, jnana and vairagya arise, and you will acquire so much jnana and so much renunciation because it will help you further with your devotion. So if our mood is devotion, then we can selectively renounce those bits which are unhelpful. And so the regulative principles do that quite well. And then we also learn through shastra, through classes, through interactions, a whole range of other things that are part of our purification of what we accept. We are advised to reject things that are unfavorable, and those things are described, things that are based on the platform of duality, interactions that may lead to one being offensive, aparads. So many things we can reject. But we can look at the kind words of our well-wishers from the past. We may view them as karmis, perhaps. That's not the full picture, because they also have the Supreme Lord in their heart. And there is so much to be learnt from each person. You know, there is a saying, it takes a village to grow a child. When there is a child growing up, it is not just the effect of the parents. It is not just the effect of the teacher. It is the effect of many people, including, as you know, you say, the stereotypical village idiot. Before that, you know, you talk about the village idiot. There's always someone in the village who's the village idiot. So even the village idiot has something to contribute to our progress. Everything. So a whole range of persons, factors, situations are involved in our progress. And if we just learn to pick what was beneficial, what was desirable, what was the lesson that I learned, maybe I behaved in a really inappropriate way, and then some reaction came, that's a lesson. That then takes that mundane experience and puts it onto the platform of spiritual. Because you're now using that to progress. So in a similar line, many people will give us advice. And they are generally well-wishers. So when we receive advice from our well-wishers, we shouldn't deride it. But we should also process that advice within a platform of higher understanding. So sometimes people out of ignorance will speak so many things. And if we are also ignorant, we won't know. In one sense, a person gives advice to another person who is unable to come to that conclusion themselves. That's the only purpose of advice, isn't it? After all, if I advise someone of something, I'm thinking that this person has not come to that understanding themselves. Therefore, I need to give them something. And it's said also, there's a saying, the path to hell is paved with good intentions. So you have to bear this point in mind as well. That person may be a well-wisher, and they may have good intentions, but they might not be right. Sometimes being right is also important. We are coming to this process of Krishna consciousness. It's very fashionable within our society to keep saying it's not about whether you're right or not. But actually it is. You're trying to study the absolute truth. You're trying to come to the absolute truth. You are trying to learn what is right and what is wrong. What is utsrija? Ye shastra vidim utsrija. What is incorrect? What is wrong? What is correct? You are trying to learn that. What is correct is those things that please Krishna. What is incorrect is those things which do not please Krishna. So we have to also know what's correct. And so if a well-wisher, maybe if you're from a family of devotees, then you'll have a spectrum of well-wishing devotional assistance. We can respect that for what it is. And we can thank them for it also. And then we can selectively take those items and practice them if they are in accordance with the recommendations we get from Krishna, the devotees, and our spiritual master, Shastra. So we don't have to be one or the other. It's not a case of rejection. And actually, this is one thing we're supposed to give up, actually, acceptance and rejection. This as a notion is something we are supposed to give up. We like something, we don't like something. Now our metrics are a bit different. We're thinking, will it help me to Krishna? Will it not help me to Krishna? And therefore, we still apply the consideration from duality. Okay, is for Krishna? Should I accept it or should I reject it? Do you see what you've done? You've tried to come to Krishna, but you've now accepted very materialistically a process which is only material. So better to have a more broad-minded approach. That it's not really about acceptance or rejection. What is it that is going to help me progress further? Let me gravitate towards doing those things more. And actually, the thing is, when we become more and more attached to Krishna, naturally, all the other improper instructions, they sort of fade away. We don't have to really meditate on them constantly. They just sort of disappear. You know, people talk about false ego. And how sometimes people say false ego means, or overcoming false ego means to think yourself to be very low, or to think yourself less. You know, just to think yourself in a very lowly condition. You're insignificant, you're very, very less, very insubstantial. But actually overcoming false ego, if you just turn it round, it actually just means think less of yourself. How you can survive. Take the effort, take the focus away from yourself. So similarly, duality, when we're surrendering to Krishna, it means that we try to focus on Krishna and we try to move away from all these other factors that we are processing in an attempt to come to Krishna. We just have to be careful and just put things into perspective. There's a few points there. Yes, Sudhabha Prabhu.
Thank you, Prabhu, for your class. I'm just wondering, in this interaction between Gopinath Acharya and Sarvabhaum Bhattacharya, obviously Gopinath Acharya was his brother-in-law, so they had an ongoing relationship. I'm just wondering whether you've heard anything about this conversation of Mayavad and things. Is this the first time they had this conversation about Mayavad, or is it that he had spoken to him about it previously, but now he saw Mahaprabhu, there was a heart change? Or I'm just wondering if you've ever heard anything on that.
Yes, well, the indication is that it had happened before, because the frustration experienced by Gopinath Acharya and the way he's describing Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya's propensity suggests that these discourses took place. Here also there's a familiarity which is described with discourses about the impersonal and impersonal. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya mentioned this a few verses ago, that we are trying to discuss. And in the next verse, you also, I think you're giving class tomorrow, is it? Okay. So in tomorrow's verse, this comes up about let me just find it. I lost my page. Discussion amongst friends, considering points in scriptures. So we can see that this type of thing happened before. And being intimately connected, devotees are always talking about the Supreme Lord. And the impersonalists are always resisting based upon their impersonal understanding. So I'm not sure if there's an explicit account of it, but certainly it would seem that if the conversation as it is now is flowing in a natural way, it would appear that similar conversations have happened in the past. And certainly Mayavadis spend a lot of time discussing Siddhanta Vedanta philosophy. They do that routinely. And so part of that would be the derisory consideration of the Lord's form. So it would be inconceivable that he would be such an exalted Mayavad and a very high-standing one from a high class of Mayavadis even, the Bhattacharyas, and he would not have gone through refuting multiple personal arguments. So it would seem to be something that's happened routinely. So Mayavadis can resist devotional arguments. But what's different now? What's different is that Lord Chaitanya has appeared in person. And so the same arguments, the same discussions, the same considerations now are going to come to a different conclusion. So that's something special that can happen. The Lord sends his mercy to assist the devotees who are constantly talking about the Lord anyway. And he does something, he sparks something special. Is that roughly?
Thank you.
Hare Krishna. Thank you so much for your class, Prabhu. Really enjoy your classes. Just looking at this theme of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, you were mentioning how, you know, he, from being a Mayavadi, became one of like the most exalted devotees. My question is there a right way to transition into devotional service? And the reason I ask this is because, like, I see it with myself. I probably appreciated the devotional jargon, the externals, the presentations of a devotee, and then chose to dive in head first into devotional service. And then now get into these intricacies and I'm realizing I actually didn't know anything. And then I'm caught in a limbo between rejecting material life and understanding that, you know, it's not really good for me, but not really being in the right situation in spiritual life. So is there a right way? And this can cause like frustrations and many doubts. Is there a right way to make this transition? Because if Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya came from being a serious Mayavadi, who was actually battling or going against or, you know, rebuttaling with a pure devotee, but then makes this transition, is there a right way to do so that we can actually be like Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya eventually? What's your take on that?
Well, I was just remembering your first point. You said diving deep. Well, the thing is, actually, we haven't really dived that deep. we're actually just, the analogy that's given is we're just licking the outside of the jar of honey. You know, you've got a jar of honey and you're helping yourself and the bits are dripping out. And at the moment, all we're doing is licking a little drop from the outside of the jar of the honey. So diving in means uncovering that honeypot and jumping in. So that's, you still have to look forward to that. So don't dismiss it because we haven't experienced it yet. There's plenty to look forward to. And all we're doing at the moment, as you've mentioned, is because you're attracted to certain things. You're attracted to certain, maybe, ways devotees behave. Maybe some of the material aspects, even the four regulative principles, are appealing to persons who are in a higher material mode. They can see that those are more saintly. But they're not spiritual. Those regulative principles are not spiritual. They're simple techniques to stop you committing more sinful activities. But we might be attracted to them, and so we might come to the movement. The thing is, we just keep going with it. And if there's any frustration, it's because we're impatient. There should not be any frustration. We've started off from position A, the train has left the station, you know, from one location. It's on the tracks moving to the next destination. It's going through valleys and hills and up and down. And if you're in India, there's random persons walking through the train offering you different items when you're trying to sleep. All these disturbances going on. It's just part of the journey. But you will get to the other end. So we just have to put up with that and just realize that, yes, the train is on it's in progress. Hopefully it won't break down. It'll keep going. If I stick to the path, the train of Krishna never breaks down. So if all I do is just hang on in there in the carriages, and don't leave the station, don't leave too early, you know, don't jump out on a station halfway along, then we will make it. And then you really get the jar of honey. So yeah, whatever ecstasy we've got at the moment is just a tiny amount, actually. Tiny amount of what is possible. Huge amount. It's unlimited. Read the descriptions in the CC about Lord Chaitanya, the unlimited ocean of bliss. Everyone was inundated. Everyone was swimming in this ocean, Lord Chaitanya's kirtan. It's inconceivable to us. But it ever increases also. So just that little drop is bigger than a material ocean for us. But it's has much more potential. So keep your spirits up. Keep dancing. Any other questions, comments? Yes, Ram Lakshman Prabhu.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji. First of all, apologies for not offering you a proper mic. I was just contemplating this exchange between Gopinath Acharya and Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, and something that Sutta Prabhu brought up was that did they have this conversation before, and what was different? And you answered it and said it was because now Mahaprabhu was present and his mercy was given to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. I mean, also know with Prakashananda Saraswati that he was also Mayavadi and also had the transformation of heart.
Yes.
And I was just thinking that I'm sure there are exchanges that we have with people who are quite hard-hearted, who may be atheistic or who may also be Mayavadis. And how is it, because it seems in this context that they had this exchange and later on Mahaprabhu preached to him and he had a change of transformation. So I was just thinking, is it that the transformation took place because it was on a intellectual level that he was preached to by Mahaprabhu? And therefore, what about us? Because is it the case that if we are going to meet someone like that who's hard-hearted, that the only way that they'll be receptive or open up or that transformation will take place is if we are having an intellectual discussion with them? Or is it like you said, that the mercy has to be there? And if so, then how do we invoke the Lord's mercy upon that person to transform their heart?
It is a fact that the intellect is not going to help matters. It is a fact that the mercy is the actual thing that will transform a person's existence from mundane to spiritual. Only the mercy of the Lord. We can analyze the Lord, we can use our intellect to try to come to the conclusion that a creator is likely, that there is a supreme being, that he's powerful, that there's intelligent design. We can come to that through a process of reasoning. But for someone to decide to end their lifetimes of material degradation, just going around in this cycle of samsara, requires some mercy of the Lord. So the thing is, we are always interested in delivering mercy. And that mercy is often, it's not something that we even package and deliver. That mercy is something that kind of leaks out. And it leaks out depending on one's potency, depending on one's purity and actual practice and the mercy they've received from the Lord. Now, when you're interacting with people, you have to interact with them on the externals, on the level that they can function. So if you're speaking to a group of intellectuals and you speak something that is highly intellectually insubstantial, it won't necessarily lead to a receptivity or an exchange. So that's something that there has to be some connection. And then the Lord will allow, now the way mercy flows, the Lord will allow it to happen with or without us, regardless of what we do or don't do. But typically, a devotee, a person who wants to move forward needs to have had some connection with a devotee. So typically, if we're speaking to intellectuals and we present Krishna consciousness through intellectual understanding, intellectual rigor, then that will have an impact on them. The person will be considering it intellectually, and it may make sense to them. And simultaneously, they may receive a little mercy if they make some inquiries. If you're dealing with someone who's not at all intellectually based, there are many people like that, most people actually, and you relate to them on a platform that they can comprehend or that they will relate to. Some people may be, just to give an example, different people have different hobbies, different interests, you know. Some people may be highly artistic. If we present some aspects of the art of Krishna, now serving Krishna is an art form. Beautiful preparations, beautiful garlands, beautiful decorations, they're part of Krishna's beauty. How much art there is in the world created by Krishna. You know, artists are very proud of creating art. You know, they might draw a picture. But who's the original artist? Who made the art around you? You go outside, go onto the front lawn, look at the trees. Who made that art? Krishna. That can work with an artist. He's the supreme artist, the supreme actor on a stage who remains undetected. That's him. Think of anything. Anything, because Krishna in chapter 10, chapter 11, and other places in the Gita clearly explains how he can be seen, how he can be perceived in his creation. I'm the taste of the water, the light of the sun, the fragrance of the earth. You can always connect to someone. And then, if you have some purity, some potency, then that mercy will leak out. So both are there. The mercy is the actual substance. That's what I would say. Okay. Thank you very much. Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita ki. Srila Prabhupada ki.